I want to start today with a contradiction. It's probably the oldest, most annoying headache in the entire history of engineering.
I think I know where you're going with this.
It's the kind of thing that must keep material scientists up at night. You want to build something indestructible, you've got two choices, and they usually hate each other.
You're talking about the classic dilemma, strength versus toughness.
Exactly. The trade-off, if I make a metal incredibly hard, so it can hold up, a skyscraper without bending, it usually turns into glass. Figuratively,
Things brittle.
it becomes brittle. You hit it with a hammer, and instead of denting, it just shatters.
Right. It has a high resistance to deformation, but a very low resistance to a crack propagating.
But then if you flip it and you make it tough, so it can take a real beating, absorb energy, dent a little, but not break, it usually gets too soft.
And you can't build a skyscraper out of rubber.
You can't. Historically, that's just been the rule, right? You sacrifice one to get
I
the
see your
other.
poison, yes.
Well, today we are diving into a paper that looks at that rule and essentially says, no thanks, we'll take both.
I love this paper.
We're looking at a study from 1983 by HKD Padeshia and DV Edmonds. The title is a bit of a mouthful. Bainite in Silicon Steels, New Composition Property Approach, Part 2.
It is a mouthful, but don't let that title fool you. This is a really seminal piece of work. This is the moment where metallurgy stopped being just about, mixing stuff in a cauldron to see what happens.
And started being about.
It started being about atomic architecture.
That's a great phrase. And the mission here is just fascinating. These metallurgists used pure theory thermodynamics to hack the microscopic structure of steel. They wanted to create an alloy that is incredibly strong and surprisingly tough.
And they did it by looking at the steel at a scale that is, I mean, it's almost impossible to imagine without an electron microscope.
We've got experimental data, we have some really ghostly looking dark field microscopy images, and we have something called X-ray diffraction analysis of fracture surfaces.
Which sounds like CSI. Metallurgy.
It basically is, isn't it? It's forensic science for metal.
It is.
I just love that. So I'm fascinated by this idea that you can design a metal's behavior just by like rearranging its microscopic furniture. Where do we even begin?
Well, we have to set the stage with the material itself. We're talking about bainite. This is a specific microstructure that forms in steel when you cool it at a very specific rate.
Okay, so bainite is our base,
Yeah.
and the title mentions silicon steels. I usually think of silicon, I think computer chips.
Right.
Is it doing the same thing here?
Not quite. Here, silicon is a structural player. It's
Perfect.
absolutely vital. But to understand why this is part two, we have to look at what happened in part one. In the previous study, the researchers had created a silicon-rich steel that was incredibly strong. I mean, they had the strength part of the equation nailed
No, let
down.
me guess. It failed the toughness test.
It was inadequate. It was strong, sure. But when they did the impact testing, it just didn't perform. It was brittle.
It had a glass
It had a
jaw.
glass jaw. Exactly.
Okay, so they have a strong but fragile metal. That's a dangerous combination.
Yeah.
So who's the villain in this story? What was making it so brittle?
The culprit is something called blocky retain austenite.
Blocky retained austenite. That sounds, well, clunky. Can you paint a picture for us? What is this stuff?
So steel isn't just one thing. It's a mixture of different phases, different crystal structures of iron and carbon. Austenite is the phase that exists at high temperatures.
Right.
Usually, when you cool steel down, all that austenite transforms into other things like ferrite or bainite.
Okay, so it changes its costume as it cools.
Exactly. But in these high silicon steels, the reaction stops before all the austenite can transform. Some of it gets left behind.
It's retained, hence retained austenite, the leftovers.
The leftovers. Now, in the part one experiments, these leftovers got trapped in these large, unstable chunks between the plates of the good stuff, the bainitic ferrite.
So you had these big islands, these blocks. Why is that bad?
It's worse than just taking up space. It's a ticking time bomb. Because these blocks are relatively large and have a certain carbon content, they're chemically and mechanically just shaky,
Oh.
unstable.
Okay.
So if the temperature drops too much, or if the metal gets hit, if it's stressed, those blocks suddenly snap into a different phase called martensite.
And martensite is
Very hard, but very, very brittle. Think of it
brittle.
like a ceramic.
I see. So you've got these hidden brittle bombs inside the metal.
Yeah.
The moment you put stress on the steel, those blocks snap and create a crack.
Precisely. The blocks are the weak link. They are the initiation points for failure. The source material specifically says this blocky morphology is detrimental to toughness.
So the goal of this study was basically, Get rid of the blocks.
Or, more accurately, change their shape.
Hmm.
They didn't want to get rid of the austenite entirely, and we'll get to why later, but they wanted to minimize the blocky stuff and maximize something they called film austenite.
Film austenite.
Yes. Instead of big chunks, you want these thin layers, films trapped between the crystals.
Okay, I'm trying to visualize this. So the blocks are like chunks of hard candy in a cookie. You bite down, you crack a tooth.
That's a good way to see it, yeah.
And the films are more like the layers in a croissant or plywood.
A laminated structure, yes, that's a great analogy. Mechanically, layers hold together much better, but chemically, these thin films are also much more stable.
Okay, so we want to go from chunks to layers.
Huh?
How do you tell steel to do that? You can't just ask it nicely.
No, you have to use thermodynamics. And this is where the genius of the paper comes in. They didn't just guess. They used thermodynamic equations, specifically looking at something called the T0 curves, to predict exactly how to do it.
T0 curves. That sounds intense. What does that actually mean?
Think of it as an energy budget for the material. The T0 curve maps out the limit of how much carbon the austenite can hold before it absolutely must transform.
Right.
By calculating this curve, they could design a recipe to basically starve the blocks of their fuel.
So they're playing nutritionist for the steel. Starve the blocks, feed the films.
Exactly. And they came up with two distinct methods to solve the problem.
Okay, let's break them down. Method one. I'm calling this the diet approach.
Method one was a diet. They decided to just reduce the overall carbon content of the alloy.
Low-carb steel.
In a way, yes. The specific alloy was an iron 0.22% carbon steel with some manganese and silicon.
And what's the logic there? Why does less carbon fix the block problem?
It's all about when the transformation stops. If you start with less carbon in the whole system, the austenite gets enriched with carbon as the bainite forms, but it reaches a point where the remaining austenite is chemically stable as thin films before it can clump up into those big unstable blocks.
You cut off the supply line before the enemy can build its fortress.
That's a perfect way to put it.
Okay, that makes sense. Less carbon, less trouble. What was method two?
Method two is what you could call the chemical shift. Instead of just lowering carbon, they modified the other alloying elements. Specifically, they added nickel.
Nickel. Okay. Why nickel?
So the alloy was FeSc0.39C4.08Ni2.05Si. So higher carbon this time, almost double, but with about 4% nickel.
And what does the nickel do?
It shifts the thermodynamic boundaries. Remember those T0 curves?
Mm-hmm.
Nickel physically moves the curve. It allows the austenite to hold more carbon while still remaining stable at lower temperatures.
So it changes the environment, makes the austenite more comfortable as a film.
Exactly. It buys the material more room to exist as stable films, even with more carbon around. It changes the chemical rules of the game.
So one approach is remove the fuel, the carbon, and the other is upgrade the engine with nickel so it can handle more fuel.
That is a fantastic analogy, yes. And we should note, these were not backyard experiments. We're talking 20-kilogram vacuum induction melts.
Precision cooking.
Absolute precision. They had to be sure what they were seeing was the result of their design, not some random impurity.
So they have the theory, they cooked the metal. Now, the moment of truth. Did it work?
Uh-huh.
Let's talk visuals. The paper has these dark field imaging micrographs.
These images are really striking. Dark field imaging is a technique in electron microscopy that lets you light up only specific parts of the crystal structure.
So it's like using a black light to find austenite.
Something like that, yes. They tuned it to only light up the retained austenite.
And what did they see?
In the old steel, you'd see these big irregular patches of light. Those were the blocks. Ugly, chunky. But in these new alloys, both of them, the blocks were virtually gone.
And what was there instead?
Delicate thin lines. Interlath films of retained austenite is the technical term. The structure was refined. It looked organized.
It's that difference again between a chunky stew and a laminated pastry.
Or a composite material, exactly.
Right. If you have big chunks, it falls apart.
Yeah.
But with layers like plywood, it holds together.
And critically, these films are chemically more stable. They don't just snap into brittle martensite because of a cold draft. They just sit there waiting.
You keep saying waiting. Waiting for what?
We'll get to that. That's the secret weapon. But first, we have to confirm, did this actually make the steel tougher? Because pretty pictures are nice, but...
But if the bridge falls down, nobody cares about the micrograph.
Exactly.
Okay, so the impact tests.
They use the Charpy impact test. This is the gold standard. You take a notched sample of the steel and you swing a massive pendulum hammer at it.
And you want it to absorb a lot of energy before it breaks.
You want it to struggle. and the results were dramatic. The new steels performed so much better than the Part 1 steel. The nickel alloy in particular had a fantastic impact transition curve. It stayed tough even as it got colder.
But did they lose strength? That was the original trade-off.
No, that is the beauty of it. The tensile strength was still incredibly high. We're talking between 1420 and 1610 meganewtons per square meter.
Give me a sense of scale on that. Is that a lot?
It is massive. Typical structural steel might be around 250 to 400. High-strength steel might be 700 or 800. This is double that. And the hardness was consistent, around 430 to 450 Vickers. So they did it. They achieved the Holy Grail, kept the massive strength, but fixed the brittleness by turning blocks into films.
That is just incredible. But this is where it gets really interesting for me. The why. They did what I'm calling CSI metallurgy. They analyzed the fracture surfaces with x-rays.
Yes, the section on x-ray analysis is brilliant forensic work. They wanted to know how the steel died.
And they did something called depth profiling. Explain that.
So they took the broken pieces from the test, they fired x-rays at the very surface of the crack, and then they compared that to the material just a tiny bit deeper, about 14 micrometers down.
14 micrometers, that's tiny.
Less than a hair's width. But in metallurgy, it's a different world. It's far enough away to be undisturbed.
And what was the difference between the surface and 14 microns deep?
Deep inside, at 14 micrometers, the retained austenite was still there. It showed up clearly on the x-ray patterns. Those were our films.
Okay. So the films are just hanging out, doing fine. And at the surface?
Gone. At the crack surface, specifically in the 0 to 3 micrometer range, the austenite had disappeared. It had transformed into martensite.
So wait. If it transformed into martensite, isn't that the bad brittle stuff?
Mm-hmm.
I thought we spent this whole time trying to avoid martensite.
Ah, and this is the nuance. This is the real moment of the study. We want to avoid unstable transformation. Where it happens spontaneously, that creates cracks.
Right.
But here, the transformation was stress-induced.
Stress-induced.
Think about a crack moving through the steel. A crack carries a massive wave of energy and stress right at its tip.
Okay.
As that stress wave hits these stable films of austenite, the stress becomes so high that it forces the austenite to transform.
And that transformation
consumes energy.
Uh-huh. It eats the energy of the crack.
Exactly. It is a shock absorber. The austenite films sacrifice themselves, and they absorb the kinetic energy of the crack to fuel their own transformation. And that energy absorption robs the crack of its momentum.
That is incredible. So the blocks were bad because they were too unstable. They'd break if you looked at them wrong.
Right.
But the films are like an airbag. They sit there quietly until the exact moment of impact. Then they deploy, they transform, and absorb the crash.
That is the perfect analogy. This is known as the Treppe effect transformation-induced plasticity. By making the austenite stable films, they ensured it would only transform when it was absolutely necessary to fight a crack.
So the material is actually smart.
Yeah.
It reacts to the threat.
And the x-ray data proved it. The austenite was gone only at the fracture surface. That proves the transformation happened during the break as a defense mechanism.
So wrapping this up, the conclusion of the paper basically says, our theory was right.
In scientific terms, yes. They concluded the theoretical model was successful. They proved you can use thermodynamics to actually design a microstructure from the ground up.
And we have to give a final shout out to silicon. Why was it so crucial?
Silicon is the enabler. Without it, carbon would just precipitate out as cementite iron carbide. And cementite is brittle. It's just another thing to break.
So silicon plays defense.
It inhibits the cementite. It forces the carbon to stay in the austenite. It basically herds the carbon atoms where we want them to be.
So silicon herds the carbon into the austenite, and then nickel, or the low carbon recipe, makes sure that austenite takes the shape of helpful films, not harmful blocks.
Precisely. It's this complex dance, but the result is a steel that just defies the usual trade-offs.
The final verdict really seems to be that they prove you can design these high-strength, tough steels by mathematically controlling the stability of this leftover austenite.
It really shifted the paradigm. It moved metallurgy from, you know, mix it and see what happens to calculate and design.
So to summarize what we've unpacked today, we started with a strong but brittle material. We found the villain. Blocky retained austenite. We used thermodynamics to create two new recipes.
We verified with microscopy that the blocks turned into films.
And we proved with impact tests and x-ray forensics that these films act as microscopic airbags, transforming under stress to absorb energy and stop cracks.
A perfect summary.
It really makes you think about the nature of stability. The researchers improved this material not by making it perfectly rigid, but by making part of it unstable in a very controlled way.
Controlled instability.
Right. They use the transformation itself, the instability, as a safety feature. If the material is perfectly stable, it would have just shattered. It survived because it could change.
Which is so counterintuitive, but brilliant.
And that's the thought I want to leave you with today. We usually think of instability as a flaw, something to be eliminated. But here, in the atomic lattice of steel, controlled instability is the very thing that prevents catastrophic failure. Where else in engineering, or even our own lives, is instability actually a hidden safety mechanism, just waiting for the right stress to activate?
Something to ponder.
Thanks for diving in with us. We'll see you on the next one.